Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Cushman, Managing Editor with Inside Climate News, who examines the links between climate change and extreme weather patterns that brought devastating floods to southeast Texas. Bo Webb of the group Coal River Mountain Watch, who responds to the Trump administration's suspension of funds needed to complete research on the health impacts of mountaintop removal coal mining. And Melinda St. Louis of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses the balance between corporate and public interest as the Trump administration renegotiates the North American Free Trade Agreement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Women's advocates in South Asia won a historic victory when India's Supreme Court ruled the instant Islamic divorce was unconstitutional. India is one of the few nations where Muslim men can get a divorce by simply saying the word talaq, or divorce in Arabic, three times. The Indian High Court ruled in favor of a petition filed by five Muslim women who were subject to the Islamic quick divorce against their will. India has become the 23rd country to outlaw talaq divorce, joining nations including Egypt, Sri Lanka, the United Arab Emirates, Malaysia, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. The Islamic quick divorce, however, continues to be practiced in ultra-conservative Saudi Arabia. Human rights advocates say poor women are the primary victims of the talaq divorce, which often leaves them without any right to alimony and destitute with nowhere to live. Many Muslim women who are forced into quick divorces now say they'll use India's progressive civil divorce laws that entitle a wife to one-third of her husband's salary in order to pay for child support and living expenses. Bronx fast food worker Flavio Cabral, who joined the Fight for $15 Minimum Wage movement 4 years ago, has seen her hourly wage at McDonald's rise to $12 an hour. Still, her dream of being able to afford to pay for her daughter's college education is still a distant goal. Fight for 15 and its allies succeeded in pressuring New York State to commit to a $15 an hour minimum wage for fast food workers, but most fast food employees work part-time and lack union workplace protections. These workers won a significant victory when the New York City Council passed a series of reforms that mandate predictable schedules and requires restaurants to offer extra hours to current workers before they hire new employees. Similar laws have been passed in Seattle and San Francisco. New York City's reforms also allow fast food workers to join a new form of labor organization, which will advocate for workers throughout the industry and sustain itself through dues deducted voluntarily from workers' paychecks. Some labor observers say this model could help launch a sector-wide fast food union, a longtime goal of the U.S. labor movement. But according to the magazine In These Times, major barriers to organizing fast food workers remain, including the rapid turnover of these low-paid employees who work directly for franchises, not the giant chains like McDonald's. America took notice last May when three white men on a light rail transit line in Portland, Oregon, bravely intervened to protect two minority women being harassed by a white nationalist. The harasser, Jeremy Christian, stabbed two of the men to death. While Portland has a reputation for being a liberal, inclusive bastion of diversity, the reality of race relations in the city tells a different story. For years, African Americans have left major cities like San Francisco, Seattle, and Portland for the suburbs. Today, blacks only make up 3% of Oregon's population, far below the national average. Traditional black neighborhoods in Portland have been gentrified and are quickly disappearing. Census numbers show 10,000 African Americans moved out of the city center between 2000 and 2010. Blacks in the City of Roses only make an average income of $30,000 a year. Meanwhile, black teenagers are in juvenile detention at five times the rate of white youths. Ellis Ray Leary, a black Portland resident, observed, "What bubbles up is this thing with a progressive veneer that covers a sinister underbelly. The question now is, how does that translate into a positive regard for Black people going forward, and what is the impact of that on white liberal cities in America? This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As large sections of Houston, America's fourth largest city, was inundated with floodwaters, driving tens of thousands of residents from their homes, the nation received yet another wake-up call regarding the increasing frequency of extreme weather events that have triggered a series of recent historic natural disasters. Since Hurricane Harvey struck the Texas coast on August 25th, parts of Houston have seen a record 50 inches of rainfall, more than the city usually receives in a year. The death toll stood at 11 on August 29th, but officials feared that number would likely rise. Federal agencies estimated that as many as 30,000 people have been forced to leave their homes for shelters, and more than 450,000 people are likely to seek federal aid. As the online publication Inside Climate News observed, the immediate priorities, rescue operations, disaster assistance, flood insurance, and the like, will be followed by broader questions involving the vulnerability of infrastructure, the energy industry and communities to extreme weather, and the need to balance mitigation of the pollution that causes climate change with adaptation to global warming's inescapable impacts. Your reporter spoke with John H. Cushman, Jr., managing editor of Inside Climate News, who examines the links between climate change and extreme weather patterns that brought devastating floods to southeast Texas, and the disconnect between public opinion that increasingly recognizes the destructive consequences of global warming and conservative politicians who continue to dismiss climate change as a hoax.
Well, I think it's safe to say that the consensus among scientists who study this closely is that we're seeing increasingly clearly the manifestations of a climate change that has been brought on by man-made pollution, principally of carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels, although there are other sources of global warming pollution as well. And when I say that we're seeing the manifestations of it, of course, there have been hurricanes for a long, long time. But scientists began to recognize 30 or 40 years ago, with increasing certainty over the past decades, that the blanket of carbon dioxide that we were surrounding our planet with was going to cause profound warming, and that we understood the physics of this, and scientists began to examine more and more closely what the symptoms would be. And among the symptoms of a warming atmosphere would be more intense rainfalls in the largest storms. Among the symptoms of warming ocean waters would be intensification of some hurricanes. Among the symptoms of global warming would be the melting of the world's ice, which would lead to sea level rise. And of course, sea level rise would also be exacerbated by the warming of the oceans. And so when you combine these things together, what you see is an increasing risk that any particular storm will produce extreme results. In other words, the dice were being loaded for the kind of event that we're seeing today. And that's different than saying climate change caused this hurricane to happen, but this hurricane's characteristics are quite consistent with what the models have forecast for a long time. And it's pretty discouraging to see that, during our lifetimes, we began to understand this, and yet we're so far from the solutions that are needed to head off even more extreme events in our children's and grandchildren's generations.
John Cushman, One of the sad ironies here is that the fossil fuel industry centered around Houston, one of the largest concentration of oil refineries in the country, is really the engine of economic growth in the Houston area and in Texas. And this is the area, of course, that's now being devastated with the extreme rainfall that we're seeing as a result of Hurricane Harvey. What can you say about what's happening there to that particular region? How much of an impact do you think that has on folks who've benefited from the economic boom that's taken place in that part of the country?
Right, and to a considerable degree, all of us have benefited from the fossil fuel era when it was in full swing. And of course, the development of the United States as the world's preeminent economy was largely related to the rise of this industry. The problem is that in developing the riches of fossil fuels, we had a mindset that the energy would be cheap, but that the pollution would be free, by which I mean that nobody was paying for the externalities, the costs that are associated with this carbon dioxide pollution. And until we recognized the costs of climate change and incorporated into the market price of fossil fuels, we are not going to be able to steer ourselves successfully to alternative fuels. And the time for alternative fuels has now arrived.
John Cushman, with a greater frequency of these extreme weather crises and the hundreds of billions of dollars that are being allocated to help people in need and who've lost their homes, their cars, what they depend on for everyday life, public opinion seems to be moving in the direction to rejecting the climate change denial that we see in the Trump administration, among the cabinet officials, and of course, President Trump himself, who just withdrew the United States from the Paris Climate Accord. Where do you see public opinion in the United States headed, given the frequency of these extreme weather situations? And what effect is that going to have on U.S. politics, where we have one particular political party, the Republicans, who champion climate change denial?
Well, you're asking me questions of which I have very little expertise or proficiency. But in this arena, I have seen, and dating back for decades as a journalist, a persistent and dedicated attempt by many different actors to confuse the public. I found myself rereading articles that I'd written in the 1990s when I was covering the environment beat in Washington, in which the petroleum industry was setting about to form committees who would make the public believe that there was too much uncertainty in the science of climate change to be able to base any policy decisions on the science as it then existed, when in fact the science had long progressed to the point, and it has continued to progress farther and farther in the direction of guiding policymakers about how to deal with these risks. And they are risks, and there are uncertainties, but it's very important not to allow uncertainty to become an excuse for inaction. That isn't where the science points us.
That was John H. Cushman, Jr., managing editor of Inside Climate News. Learn more about the links between the greater frequency of extreme weather patterns around the world and climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For years, medical research in communities near mountaintop removal coal mining sites, or MTR, has revealed higher incidences of birth defects, cancer, and early mortality than in control communities. Mountaintop removal mining blasts the tops off mountain ridges with dynamite, contaminating the air and impacting water quality. After years of grassroots organizing against MTR in southern West Virginia, the State Department of Environmental Protection and the Department of Health requested help from the Federal Office of Surface Mining to review health studies. In the waning days of the Obama administration, the office, which is part of the Interior Department, allocated $1 million for the review. However, on August 20th, the Trump administration's Interior Department halted the study in order to review all grants over $100,000. The organization leading the study, The National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine confirmed the Interior Department order and wrote, "The National Academies believe this is an important study, and we stand ready to resume it as soon as the Department of the Interior review is completed." National environmental groups condemned the decision. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bo Webb, a former board president and current member of the group Coal River Mountain Watch, who lived in the heart of the coal fields for many years and is now a leader of the effort to pressure the government to research the health impacts of MTR. For the past several years, he's advocated congressional adoption of the AIC Act, standing for the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, which would require a halt to mountaintop removal coal mining until studies can prove it's safe, something he's confident could never be substantiated. Webb organized a protest in 2015 to push for the legislation and picks up the story from there.
The head of West Virginia's Department of Health, we met with him 2 weeks, maybe 10 days later, and then he said that, you know, West Virginia didn't have the resources, the money, nor the people to really do such a review of all this research. So he contacted the Federal Office of Surface Mining at Interior, and then Joe Pasarczyk, who we had dealt with before, head of OSM, he went to the National Academy of Sciences and brought them in to do the review. And what National Academy of Sciences was doing here was a review of all of the existing research. That's all it was. It wasn't anything new. Then that was going to take them 2 years to do it. It was going to cost $1 million. They put together a team. They brought in scientists, independent scientists. They also brought in some ex-coal people that were scientists. You know, they promised they would hold public hearings, and they have been doing that, giving us up to date. And then when they would have testimony from a scientist, they did it in Charleston. They just last week did it in Kentucky. So they were in the middle of reviewing all of the research, and then Trump just put the kibosh on it and shut it down. So we know that people are getting sick and dying. And so the Trump administration basically has just decided to ignore all of that. And regardless of what the research has said, and regardless of what people that live there witnessing this say, it doesn't matter. He's basically given the green light to the coal industry to blow the mountains up. And if you kill the residents nearby, it's okay. That's really the bottom line. This review thing could cause us some problems, so let's just don't do it. Let's just stop it.
So, Bo Webb, what do you think is the next step? Do you think you can get the funding restored?
Well, that's what I'm trying to work on now, and I'm hoping to go down to D.C. in a couple of weeks here and meet with Senator Sanders' office. I spoke with him, but most of them are out on vacation. So I want to go down and talk with him and try to get some pressure applied in Congress and the Senate to get that. $1 million is a drop in the bucket. Plus, they're probably 30% into the work already. All indications are the air that people are breathing in those communities is toxic and contaminated. You know, in the United States Geological Survey identified what's in the dust, and it boils down to silica, aluminum, and molybdenum, which is a metal. And the USGS, what they did, they showed this coming from the mountaintop removal sites. They showed it in the amount of dust they were collecting. When the mines were very active, there were huger amounts of silica and aluminum in the air, in fine particulates, which enters your lungs. You don't have any defense against it. And we know physical lab work that it's causing the growth of tumors in human lungs. And it's still going on.
You have been promoting the AIC Act, which stands for Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, since 2012, but it hasn't caught fire yet in Congress. Do you think the publicity surrounding the cancellation or postponement or whatever it is of this study could jumpstart support for the bill?
Well, it will if we, and I, when I say we, I'm talking about myself and the people I work with and nonprofits all over, jump on this. If we remain silent, if people aren't working on it, it'll just die. It'll just disappear and go away. We need to do a lot of things. We need to get to D.C. and expose this and really harp on this and get this continued and bring about more awareness and hopefully just say, you know what, we just need to stop mountaintop removal right now today.
That was Bo Webb, a former board president and current member of the group Coal River Mountain Watch. Learn more about research into the health effects of mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After a contentious national debate, the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, came into force on January 1, 1994. The trade treaty between the United States, Canada, and Mexico granted new powers and privileges to multinational corporations. Key provisions in NAFTA made it easier for U.S.-based corporations to outsource jobs to cheap labor markets overseas, where governments don't protect workers' rights. NAFTA also permits corporations to challenge government regulations that protect public health, consumer safety, and the environment, and launch lawsuits to recover lost profits. Economic studies conclude that NAFTA cost hundreds of thousands of good-paying U.S. manufacturing jobs and played an important role in decimating America's middle class. During the 2016 presidential campaign, candidate Donald Trump, in contrast to the pro-free trade Republican Party, denounced NAFTA and pledged that if elected, he would either scrap or renegotiate NAFTA. After 7 months in office, the Trump administration recently completed a first round of talks to renegotiate the terms of NAFTA and is scheduled to begin a second round September 1st in Mexico City. In his speeches, Trump regularly threatens to withdraw from NAFTA if Canada and Mexico refuse to sign on to provisions that would bring back American manufacturing jobs. Your reporter spoke with Melinda St. Louis, International Campaigns Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses what must be changed in NAFTA to restore the balance between corporate and public interest, and expresses doubts that the Trump agenda on transforming the treaty will benefit American workers.
Progressives like us and the labor and environmental community have been very critical of NAFTA since the beginning, and we have been very clear that we have a list of demands of things that must come out, such as these investor protections that incentivize job offshoring, and what must go in, which is strong and enforceable labor and environmental and human rights protections that has not been a part of it, and a whole host of other things. Now, Donald Trump has also said that NAFTA was a disaster, but, you know, he talks about this in terms of America first, you know, has scapegoated Mexicans in a whole host of areas, has talks about building a wall, and also in the context of this, and so this is antithetical to the progressive vision of this. You know, he has stated that his goal is to reduce the trade deficit, which is important in terms of helping to create jobs in the United States, particularly manufacturing and other jobs that have been hollowed out in the NAFTA era. But unfortunately, what we've seen so far is the same closed process. We have not seen, you know, the texts that they're planning to put forward. The same closed process with 500 corporate advisors is intact while the public is being locked out. And so what's really important now is to call out in whose interest is this renegotiation going to happen. We have been calling for NAFTA to be replaced since the beginning. But at this point, it's really important to look at the process and to make clear what the demands are, that a tweak of NAFTA is not going to cut it in any way, that the devastation that NAFTA has wrought in terms of incentivizing offshorers, we've seen more than 900,000 jobs have been officially certified by the Department of Labor as being lost to NAFTA, and we know that's a severe undercount because it's a very narrow program. And then at the same time, there have been these provisions that allow multinational corporations to attack public health, safety, environmental safeguards, and we've seen nearly $400 million of taxpayer money has been paid to corporations by these tribunals already under NAFTA. So those are the things that we need to watch to see, are they going to eliminate these provisions that incentivize jobs offshoring and allow corporations to attack our laws? Are they going to eliminate the provisions that undermine our Buy American and Buy Local policies that are in NAFTA? Are they going to eliminate the provisions that push this deregulatory agenda so we can't regulate Wall Street and we can't regulate our food imports, et cetera? And then will there really be the types of policies and strong standards in environment and labor that lift up standards in all three countries instead of encouraging this race to the bottom that we have seen, particularly in Mexico?
Melinda, during the negotiations over the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, a very powerful coalition emerged made up of civil society groups, labor, environmental, human rights organizations, all coming out in opposition to President Obama's pushing the TPP. What's the coalition look like now that is pressuring the Trump administration and Congress to ensure the pro-worker planks are part of the NAFTA renegotiation here?
Well, you're right that there was an unprecedented coalition opposing the TPP that was large in both its numbers and breadth of different sectors, and that coalition has pivoted to NAFTA. Now, I will say that in the Trump era, many of the organizations, like the environmental organizations, the labor organizations, human rights groups, and immigrants' rights groups are under attack in a whole host of areas. I mean, that is a real problem because everyone's having to fight on multiple fronts. But I will say that same coalition, there's the Citizens Trade Campaign that brings together family, farm, environment, labor, faith groups, consumer groups. That coalition is mobilizing. There's much more to do to counter this narrative that unfortunately has been pushed in this era, which is either you are for free trade or you're a protectionist. And what we need to be clear about is who have been the winners and who are writing the rules and for whom. And we need to make sure that it's the public is centered there and not just big corporations.
That was Melinda St. Louis, International Campaigns Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Learn more about the Progressive Coalition campaigning to replace NAFTA by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KOPA in Pala, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Nikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.